Your science magazine of the air brings you another story from the human adventure.
Dramatic story of bone graft surgery.
All right, men. Our orders are to take this ridge and move on as far beyond it as we can. We'll deploy in a squad wedge. Move forward on my whistle signal. Everybody get that?
Okay, sir.
Okay, get ready to move.
You're moving forward to take that ridge and 100 other ridges all over the world. Right now, you're standing in your position in the squad wedge, waiting. Just waiting for the signal.
Burst from their gun. I got hit.
Yes, you got hit, Charlie. You, Charlie Whiteside, Private Infantry, Army of the United States. You don't feel anything at first, but you know it's your leg, your left thigh. And then you begin to feel it. A slow, deep, dull ache like nothing you've ever felt before. Shattered left thigh.
Mark him for penicillin, surgery, base hospital right away.
Looks like a bad one, Major.
Yeah. Do you want to do it or shall I?
You mean amputate?
That's what I mean.
I'm not sure, Major, but I think we may be able to save that leg. I'm not certain, but I think this is a job for bone graft surgery.
The Human Adventure will continue in just a moment. Here now is your host, the editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Mr. Walter Eust.
To the military surgeon, bone graft surgery means that some amputations will not have to be performed. To people outside the armed forces, it sometimes means the cure of tuberculosis of bone or spine, or the healing of fractures which have persistently refused to unite. To everyone, it means fewer cripples, less crippling in the world.
For hundreds of years in ancient Egypt, Babylonia, Greece, Rome, through the dark night which we call the Middle Ages, injury to bone, whether caused by disease or by physical injury or by congenital deformity, injury to bone invariably meant crippling. For these years, these centuries, men, either scientists or laymen, had no measures by which to reconstruct bones to make them strong and healthy again. And it seemed that they were no closer to an answer when in London in 1736 there began a chance discussion which concerned...
Pigs, Dr. Belcher.
Yes, of course I raise pigs.
But, sir, you are a successful calico dyer. I can't see why you should want to raise even one pig.
In the summer of 1736, Dr. John Belcher, a young English surgeon, was invited to dinner at the home of a calico printer in London.
You see, Dr. Belcher, my husband is a very economical man.
I'm sure he is, madam. But that's no excuse for raising pigs.
You see, doctor, in printing calico, we use a dye called madder. And one of the waste products is bran, which happens to be soaked in the dye.
Would you care for more soup, Dr. Belcher?
No, thank you, madam. But go on about the pigs.
Very simple, doctor. Being an economical man, my husband uses the dye-soaked bran to feed pigs. Then he uses the pigs to feed his friends.
Well, that truly is economy. But does the dye not give a strange flavor to the meat?
Dr. Belcher, if you will notice, you will see that James has already removed your soup plate and replaced it with a plate of pork.
Oh.
Now, if you just taste it...
I'm not sure that
I... Go on, doctor, taste it. And you'll find it's very good.
Say, this isn't bad. In fact, it's really quite good pork.
Thank you, Dr. Belcher.
What we are proudest of, doctor, is the decorative effect.
Decorative effect? What do you mean?
The bones, doctor. Take a look at the bones.
Why, the bones are pink.
Yes, they always are. A funny thing, though, we don't know why.
Well, sir, madam, you may not realize it, but I think you may have made a contribution to science.
A contribution to science? Perhaps. Pink pork bones may seem a scientific contribution to some people. Others are harder to convince. To the London doctor, they seemed enough of a contribution that he went ahead fed animals with bran soaked in the dye called madder, and reported a simple fact to the Royal Society.
By absolutely certain and scientific methods, I have proved that the dye called madder, when absorbed with the food of the diet, has the power of staining bones in all kinds of animals.
First, the apparently unimportant contribution, now the apparently unimportant cause. Pink pork bones appeared mostly as a dining room curiosity, even when Belcher's report was published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. And it was this way that the idea reached France, came to Henri-Louis Duhamel, a scientific dilettante.
When a growing pig is fed on a madder diet, and the diet is stopped before maturity, the pig's bones are white on the outside and pink on the inside. Bones, therefore, grow by the superimposition of one layer on another. But even more important is a simpler fact. For at least while they are growing, bones are alive.
At least while growing, bones are alive. First, the apparently unimportant fact that matter stained bone, now a theory about bone itself. A theory which was to be challenged within a single generation.
Duhamel's theory is incomplete in stating that bone is alive while growing. Actually, normal bone is alive all the time, from birth till death.
This is the voice of John Hunter, an English physician who challenged the Frenchman's theory. A man who spent so much time on research that his private practice began to suffer. Although sometimes, if rarely, he was able to combine them to good advantage.
Yeah, certainly is a nice pair of black eyes you have there.
Yeah, sure are.
Did you win the fight? It's too bad you have those black eyes, though. You ought to see what the other fellow did to you. Well, sir, I don't think you'll need any treatment. Those black eyes will take care of themselves.
But I lost a tooth, too.
Oh, you did? Well, now, how long ago was the fight?
Well, a few hours. Here's the tooth.
Second by Custard. All in one piece. I think the tooth is still alive. You know, I think we may be able to put it back in your head.
You think so?
Yes, I think so. I'll just drop the tooth in this pan of water here. Now, if you'll open your mouth while I probe the socket. Doesn't hurt, does it? That's good. All right. That part is done.
Yeah, sure is.
Now the tooth and the mallet. All right, if you'll just open your mouth again. Now the mallet. Fine. That's done. Now, just one more step.
Cut off my head?
Oh, hardly. Now I'm going to tie the tooth in place with this silk thread.
Well, I guess I can stand that.
There you are. It's done. All done this time. Now, I want you to come back to see me in a month, and we'll see how the tooth is by then.
Thus, an operation which combined fundamental research with the practical work of private practice. As John Hunter himself explained it,
the dentine, the inner part of a tooth, is quite similar to bone. For example, it takes the madder stain just as bone does. My theory in replacing the tooth in the man's mouth was simply that if the tooth were alive, the bone in his jaw would grow up around it, holding it firm just as before the fight. And a month later, when I took off the silk thread and asked him how it felt, the patient said,
"It feels like a tooth, Dr. Hunter."
Well, I guess that's as much as we can ask for. It hasn't given you any trouble, has it?
Well, I get things caught on the thread.
No. I mean the tooth.
No.
All right, sir. I think my job is done. Good luck.
Say, Doc.
Yes?
My wife is kind of a silly woman, and she wants to know if she can have that piece of silk thread, you know, for the sew with.
Seemingly, Dr. John Hunter's operation has little importance in the story of bone repair, but it was a very important operation, for it was the first to correlate certain important facts already known. First,
bone and dentine are similar if seconds. Bone and dentine are both alive continuously from birth till death.
Third,
Hunter's operation proves that a piece of bone separated from the other bone but still alive can be replaced in bone and live again.
And in summary,
if a tooth can be replaced in a jaw and live again, functioning as a normal tooth, then it might reasonably be supposed that one piece of bone could be inserted into another piece of bone and also live.
What did Hunter's operation teach about bone? Did it mean that bones could be restored as teeth were restored? Did it mean that a shoulder bone or thigh bone could be eaten away by disease, only to be miraculously cured, somehow to live again?
An abscess of the left shoulder. Does it hit, Madge?
Oh, sure, Dr. White. Of course it hurts. A lot.
Pus is coming out from several places. I say, how long ago did you notice this abscess?
Oh, about a fortnight, Doctor.
Oh? Why didn't you come to see me sooner?
Oh, I thought it might heal by itself, sir. Honest, Dr. White, please. I don't want to lose my arm.
This is the office of Dr. Charles White at the Infirmary of Manchester in England. His patient is Edmund Collette, a country boy of 14, with an abscess in his left shoulder. Now, in 1768, the standard treatment for such a disease is amputation.
I don't know, Edmund. I'm just not sure. Are you willing to take a chance?
Will it save my arm, Dr. White?
I'll take a chance, Edmund. It's never been done, to my knowledge, but I think it may save your arm.
All right, Doctor. If there's any possibility at all, I'll take the chance.
I'll take the chance. Now Dr. White makes a deep vertical incision along the upper arm, forces the end of the infected bone out through the incision, and sawing the infected end of the bone off, splints it. An hour later, the boy walks out of the office, his arm still attached to his body, but useless. For there are 4 inches of bone missing in his upper arm. Now for a month, the boy waits, and the doctor waits and wonders.
Will the bone reconstruct itself? Carefully, I'm going to take off the splint. Careful. Just a moment. Now, how does it feel?
Not too good, Doctor. Kind of a dull ache.
All right, I'll put the splint back on. After that, you can go home. We'll give it another month.
Another month, and another. And finally, at the end of 4 months...
Well, Edmund?
Feels better than before, Doctor.
Ah, good, good. Now hold both your arms out in front of you. That's fine. Well, you know, Edmund, that arm with 4 inches of missing bone is only 1 inch shorter than your right arm.
But how could that be?
The bone grew, Edmund, because the bone is alive.
Here in the shoulder of a 14-year-old boy was living proof of Dr. John Hunter's old theory of bone growth. The bone grew and the bone restored itself almost completely. The operation was called resection. Yet even 100 years after it was performed by Charles White, sometimes it worked and sometimes it failed. Failure still meant amputation. And one of the men who had performed bone resections many times was Dr. William McEwen of the Glasgow Infirmary. And at least once, William McEwen failed.
Understand, don't you, Dr. McEwen? We don't blame you at all.
You see, Doctor, the boy's arm simply has not reconstructed itself. The bones have not grown together as we all hoped they would. And that's why my wife and I have come. We want you to amputate the arm.
I see. I understand. Let me see. Your son is 5 years old now?
That's right, Doctor.
And the resection was performed 2 years ago, was it not?
Correct, sir, yes, when our son was 3 years old.
Of course, it's just possible that the failure resulted because he's a growing child. Perhaps he didn't have the resources for normal growing, plus this extra growing, which was necessary if the operation
Please,
was...
Please, Doctor, we aren't interested in why the operation failed. We're interested only in the fact that it did fail.
Madam, you are not a scientist. I am. It's my profession to inquire into the causes of medical failures. It's my profession to ask why. For if I find out the cause of failure, I may be able to prevent failure the next time. I trust you are both intelligent enough to understand that.
I'm sorry, Doctor. I understand.
All right, then. I may be able to help you without performing an amputation. But it will take a little time. If you're willing, come back and see me in a week.
What did William McEwen do that week? He sat, he brooded, he thought. From time to time, he attended to his surgical practice, often performing an operation on children with rickets, sawing little wedges of bone out of their crooked legs to make them straight again. But most of the time he sat, he brooded, and he thought.
The operation I propose, as I told you before, is not an amputation. Instead, I wish to open your son's arm and insert into it some pieces of living bone, hoping that they will unite with the bone already there to form a complete new arm bone for your son.
What a capital suggestion, Doctor.
But where will the pieces of bone come from, Doctor?
Well, I have other work, you know. At the hospital, I often remove bits of bone from rickety legs to make them stay. If I can get several of those bits of bone while they are still alive, I can put them into your son's arm as a sort of as a graft, you know.
These are clean children, are they not?
We wash them. We'll wash your son, too.
But now, what if this operation fails, too, Doctor?
Then we'll have to go ahead and perform the amputation after all.
Oh, in other words, we won't be any worse off than we are, and we may be better.
That's it exactly, sir.
All right, then, Doctor. You have my permission. You may go ahead.
There's nothing more to say about William McEwen, except that he made up for his former failure with this success, for the operation did succeed. And it was a lasting success, for in 1910, at the age of 35, the little boy who had been about to lose an arm was still whole and healthy and happy. Some people heard about bone grafting after McEwen's first success, heard about grafting and asked for it for themselves.
Well, see, it's this way, Doc. Now, you see, last winter, well, I broke my arm and it just ain't healed. And then I heard about this bone graft and they talk about
don't
it.
Don't say any more. You want a bone graft in your arm.
Yeah, I guess that's about right, Doc.
Well, I could try it, but I don't think I should. There's one difficulty about bone grafting. It's hard to get a graft that exactly fits. We can give you a crooked arm or an arm that's 3 or 4 inches short.
I see.
What I'd say is keep your arm in that splint for another year. If it's not healed by then, well, then maybe we'll try a bone graft.
But patients weren't the only people who were discouraged about bone grafts. Some of the discouraged people were the physicians themselves.
What's the trouble, dear?
Oh, another failure today, that's all.
But, Fred, you have to learn to take failures. You always told me they were much more frequent than successes.
Well, that's what I told you, but I didn't have to believe it myself, did I? Why, Luella, my grandfather was an amateur tree surgeon, and he could do a better job with trees than we do with bone grafting.
In 1910, that was a common conversation in the house of Fred Albee when he came home from his job as resident surgeon at the New York Postgraduate School of Medicine.
Well, suppose he could do a good job. If you were operating on trees, you'd probably be more successful, too. And the failures wouldn't make as much difference.
Oh, it's the tools. That's what it is.
Tools?
Of course it's the tools. A tree surgeon has the very exact tools, considering the size of the thing he works on. We don't.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Why, even a cabinet maker, a carpenter, has exact, precise, portable machine tools that...
Fred, what's the matter, dear? Why are you putting on your hat?
I don't think I'll be here for dinner, dear. I think... Well, I'm not sure, but I think I've got an idea. Well, you're a master mechanic. Can you do it or can't you?
Well, I'm not sure, Dr. Albee. Now, you want me to take this little electric motor and fix it up with a case you can boil. Are you sure you want a case you can boil?
Yes, that's what I want.
And then you want it fixed up so you can put all kinds of attachments on it.
Right, especially this little double circular saw.
You want to saw some things twice at once, huh?
I want to saw some exactly parallel lines at an exact distance apart. It's very precise work.
Say, tell me what you're going to saw that you got to be so precise. Are you going to saw gold or something?
I'm going to saw human bone.
Oh, I get it. Well, as I always say, you're the doctor.
It was hard, but Fred H. Albee got machine tools for bone graft surgery. Machine tools that mean speedier, more exact work with less shock to the patient. Fred Albee died a few months ago, but in the years before his death, he performed more than 30,000 operations. And with the aid of his machine tools, some of them took as little as 9 minutes each. With machine tools, Fred Albee brought precision, speed, and better patient care to bone graft surgery. Fred Albee demonstrated his machines and his techniques all over the world. He demonstrated at the front lines during the First World War. He made bone graft surgery a popular and practical thing.
Hey, Private. Charlie. Charlie Whiteside.
You're swimming, Charlie Whiteside. The water is warm and there's a funny smell in your nose, and it's funny, but you just can't remember
that
nice, nice dream.
How do you feel? Come on, Charlie. Tell me about it. How do you feel?
Oh, me? Well, I feel all right, I guess, but... Oh.
What's the matter, Charlie?
Nothing. I just remembered something.
Yes, you just remembered. You remember now. A minute ago, or maybe a day or a week, you've got some bullets in your leg.
Thinking about your leg, aren't you, Charlie?
Yeah. They should have left me out there, Nice. I'd have been better off. They should have left me out. Yeah.
Charlie, you didn't lose your leg.
Honest?
Honest. Here. Here, I'll hold up my mirror so you can see it.
Hey, golly. You're right. My leg is there.
Sure.
Hey, Nice.
Yes, Charlie?
Nurse, would you mind kind of attaching that mirror to the foot of my bed? You know, so as I can kind of look down and see my leg sometimes.
You look at that mirror a lot the first day, but only a couple of dozen times on the days after that. And then you settle down to the hospital routine, and the nurse comes around, and the doctor...
It's been a successful graft, Whiteside. Oh, get along, all right. Alive and kicking.
Your Science Magazine of the Year has just brought you another story from the human adventure. Today, the story of bone graft surgery. This broadcast was presented for American troops in every overseas theater of operation. Radio Service.